Welcome to Conversations with Owens Community College President, Dr. Dion D. Somerville. Welcome to today's episode of the Conversations Podcast. I'm Dr. Dion D. Somerville. Thank you for listening today. Whether this is your first time with us or if you're a longtime follower, we're so happy that you're joining us as we explore the issues and meet the people who are important to Northwest Ohio and to Owens Community College. Thank you for listening today. Please enjoy our previous episodes and subscribe to Conversations to join us for future episodes. Today, I am so excited to welcome Dr. Karen Stout, President and CEO of Achieving the Dream. During her more than 40 years working with community colleges, Dr. Stout has also served as President of Montgomery County Community College and Vice President and Campus Executive Officer of Camden County College. She was named on Washingtonian's 500 Most Influential People list in 2023 and EdTech's 30 Higher Education IT Influencers to Follow in 2023. She is the recipient of the Robert Zemsky Medal for Innovation in Higher Education, amongst many other recognitions. Dr. Stout holds a doctorate in educational leadership from the University of Delaware, a master's degree in business administration from the University of Baltimore, and a bachelor's degree in English from the University of Delaware. She has also earned honorary degrees from Miami-Dade College and Montgomery County Community College. Hi, Dr. Stout. Thank you for being our guest today. Karen, welcome to the Conversations Podcast. I'm so excited to have this opportunity to talk with you. I'm an admirer of your work, not only at Achieving the Dream, but what you've done throughout your career to really take care of human beings and help them realize their potential. And so I'm a huge admirer of yours. And so what we ask all of our podcast guests is, how did you know that you needed higher education?
My mom did not go to college. My dad graduated with his bachelor's degree from the University of Baltimore after 8 years of night school. He was a Marine and then used the GI Bill to go to college. And I can remember listening to my mom and dad talk about how many credits he would register for each semester while he was working as a truck driver. And they would argue about the number of credits because she wanted him to take more so that the GI Bill benefits were accelerated enough that what was left over could help with household expenses. I remember that those conversations. I also remember sitting with my dad when I was in like fourth grade, doing my math homework next to him while he did his homework. And that's the year he graduated from the University of Baltimore. So that image was implanted into my head then. And my parents, there was really no choice. We were going to go to college. The key was, though, the affordability around going to college. I was also an athlete, and I call myself a Title IX baby. I was lucky when I was in high school sports. I was a three-sport athlete, and colleges were just starting to recruit female athletes. There was some scholarship money. So that's actually how I landed at University of Delaware. I was a field hockey scholarship recipient. They had a Division I field hockey team. I had some other offers too, but I picked Delaware because the ability to play at a high level of field hockey competitively, but also have a really strong academic experience. And I majored in English. And, you know, I remember my mom saying to me, you'll never get a job majoring in English. And that was way back. You know, there are fewer English degrees now, but I totally disagree with that sentiment. But Delaware was foundational for me because of the athletic experience, definitely, and how athletics has shaped my thinking about leadership and service and strategy, but also because it was large enough to give me a lot of experiences, but small enough. I was editor of the newspaper my senior year. I had an internship in the sports information office. I took every opportunity that I could to be immersed in my academic life as well as my athletic life. And in fact, I'm being inducted into the university's English Hall of Fame. So that's very meaningful to me. I often say about it now that it was, in a way, my community college because of the affordability. I would have gone to the local community college if not for the opportunity at University of Delaware. And I learned about the importance of those faculty supports, the coaching supports, and in taking advantage of all those supports and having the courage to be vulnerable and ask for help, which I needed a lot of.
It's interesting because I believe that so many people, when they think of collegiate athletics, they think of the Power Five and they think of football and basketball.
And people really forget about who most student athletes really are. And I really believe that, like you, for me, being a student athlete was an important part of my identity. So many things that you learn through being a participant in a team sport that are different lessons than what you get in other parts of the university or the college. You talked a little bit about leadership and sense of service and things of that nature. Can you talk a little bit about how being an athlete has kind of shaped your professional persona?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, some of it is just in the commitment to the discipline of being an athlete, to practice, to the habit of practice, to being able to receive constructive feedback and use it for improvement, and that relationship with your coach. That's a piece of it. I think as a teammate, I like to think that, you know, really good athletes, you know, they know their position, but great athletes know where their teammates are on the field. That ability to expand your range of thinking and vision. And I, you know, I'm talking mostly about field hockey at this moment, but it could also, I played softball in college as well. In some cases, it relates to softball, but I was a center midfielder. So that's where the service piece comes. I was the person that took the ball from defense into offense. And that was my job. I was the link. I set up the score. I set up my teammates to be in the best possible position to finish. And in a lot of ways, I feel like that's what leadership is about. You're in the middle. You're the link. You're setting up your teammates to finish something. And then the other piece of it is the strategy behind most sports. I mean, I think that in order to be successful, you have to be prepared at a certain level so that you can be spontaneous enough to take your preparedness to the next level. In field hockey, there are certain plays called set pieces. If you have really strong set pieces, then that allows you to do that fun, spontaneous work and to do it successfully. So thinking about strategy that way, and all leaders need to be able to play offense and defense. And knowing when you have to be defensive and when you can be offensive. And defense is a lot harder than offense. As I look at today's leaders, you know, I often will say, yes, you want to be playing offense all the time. It's creative. It's fun. But you can't play offense without having a solid defense. And sometimes we're in defense a lot more than we're in offense. Since we're conversational and we're on athletics. In July, I was part of a team that went to England and played in the field hockey World Masters tournament. And we won the bronze medal, but it reminded me of all of the pieces of athletics that I love, and that being in a position again to get coaching, how wonderful. Again, I think all leaders, no matter how long we've been in our positions, benefit from coaching and feedback, whether it's formal or informal.
Absolutely. So our relationship, you know, obviously we knew, as Owens knew, achieving the dream, but I had the privilege of you being my mentor in the Aspen Presidential Fellowship. And when I think of professional development opportunities like that, it's the coaching from a, you know, mentoring perspective, but it's also what you get from your peers, from your colleagues. It's really some of that same kind of sentiment of, oh, you had experience in this, or you're doing this, or what do you think about XYZ? And so all of that really kind of comes together to feed that intellectual need that we all have in our professions and how we want to continue to grow and learn.
That sense of community is so important for leaders. We all have different circles of community, and you have your community with Owens and the Owens community, and you're growing from that experience, and so is the community, and so is the college. But you need other circles of community to continue to grow so that you can support Owens in growing, because that's how that works. The curiosity that's sparked by being in that Aspen community of learners. You have to contextualize everything you learn in those environments. Owens is unique and superb in the work that you're doing in the community, but different than every other community college in the country.
So when we talk about that continued learning, your learning didn't stop with your undergraduate experience. You went to Baltimore and to Delaware. And how did those experiences kind of shape your professional experience, or even what prompted you that you knew that you wanted graduate education?
I did not know exactly what I wanted to do after I got my English degree. I did go to work at a chamber of commerce in the same town as the university is in. And you know, I started to look at opportunities to continue my education, but I had to work. I couldn't just go on as a full-time graduate student. So I thought, well, I'll immerse myself for a little bit in the work so that I can figure out really what I want to do. But I was inspired to get my master's degree and the MBA specifically by my father, because he went to the University of Baltimore and finished his bachelor's degree and then his master's degree in business administration. So that was a mental map for me. But at the same time, at that point, I started working at my hometown community college, Hartford Community College, in the admissions office. I was doing high school recruitment, and I was really starting to get interested in the student demographics, different types of marketing and recruitment techniques, the business model behind all of that. And so I thought, wow, the MBA might be a good match for the English degree. And so that's what I did. And then I thought, well, I'll keep going because the college president at Hartford at the time, who I was doing strategic planning for at that point, said to me, you can be a community college president, but you need a doctorate. I thought, oh, I can't be a community college president, but it sounds interesting to get a doctorate. So back to University of Delaware. And again, the options were limited for really good doctoral programs in that had a higher education, you know, perspective that were part-time, because I had to keep working. I could not afford to just stop. And at the time, you probably know UT Austin was the program everybody recommended that I go to, but you had to be able to stop out of work in order to do that. I couldn't do that. So I did back then what was kind of a non-traditional thing and decided on Delaware. And both experiences, I think, added a lot. I'll tell you, the MBA later in my presidency and now in my presidency at Achieving the Dream, very valuable budget planning, financial analysis, all of that fundamentally important for us as leaders.
That sounds absolutely incredible. Well, and I'm sure that Delaware was more than thrilled to have you back. It's interesting though, because you think about a lot of the work that we do in community colleges, it's really about every student having their own path. And with the example of your father as a lifelong learner and an adult learner, whichever term, you know, is preferred, he kind of did that at a time that there were very few supports for adult learners, returning adults.
I think back on that, and I totally agree. I mean, there weren't the same types of holistic supports that we have for students now. It's interesting. In some ways, I think we were more aware of adult scheduling needs back then because there were so many veterans using GI Bill benefits. And so the organizing things in night school formats was commonplace. And then, you know, even community colleges as a movement, somehow we forgot about the adult students. I think there's a big renaissance in our movement right now about adult reentry. Thank goodness, right? Mm-hmm. Because of so many people that have college credits and no degree, or they could benefit from some type of post-secondary pathway. It doesn't have to be a college credential. It could be, you know, a non-degree credential that has value, but we still are offering those credentials as community colleges. But thank goodness we're thinking about that now.
Absolutely. And a lot of our growth has been adult students. I would imagine every state in the country is talking about workforce, and there's only so many high school graduates. We've known that this was coming. The statistics have been out there for well over a decade that the population was going to shift. But to me, it really is about going back and being steadfast in our mission as community colleges, because if our communities aren't thriving, or we have people in our communities who aren't able to avail themselves of higher education, then we've kind of missing a piece of what it is we're supposed to be doing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, and I know you're doing this at Owens, I mean, really understanding who's missing from your mm-hmm. campus and going deeper into your community in new ways, you know, with trusted partners who can influence prospective learners in a way that we can't influence because mm-hmm. for whatever reason, we don't have the same level of the trust that really there is a pathway, it can be affordable, and it can get you into a job that's above a living wage, which is really what we need to be able to promise adult students that.
It's the trust and the credibility. Speaking of the pathways and trusted partners, I'm sure there are a lot of folks who will be listening to the podcast who may not understand what Achieving the Dream is and what the mission of the organization is about. So would you like to share that?
Achieving the Dream is a national nonprofit. It's a very unique organization. It's been in existence for 21, going on 22 years soon. Founded with philanthropy, with a goal to work with community colleges to get more students into and through the colleges. And at first, the focus of Achieving the Dream was fully on completion. And as you know, the movement has evolved. And now we work with more than 300 community colleges are in our network. Our work touches 500 community colleges and open access universities. And we work with those colleges to build capacity, not just to help students complete, but to help colleges build capacity to make sure that students move through and earn a degree of value or a degree of opportunity, whatever language you want to use around that, that helps accelerate their mobility economically. And that translates into what that means for the community, which is where I think, a lot of community colleges have not been able to translate how the work they do that supports student mobility translates to what that means for the prosperity of the community. We have a framework that we work with colleges to help them organize all of their student success activities. And then, the big key for ATD is we really help you understand your data, the data about your students and the data about your communities, so that you can begin to formulate what your own unique theory of action is around transforming the lives of the students that you serve, but also transforming the community. I love what we do. I think it's a very unique mission. I think we were the start of a lot of other sectors of higher education having similar versions of Achieving the Dream. We still have a lot of colleges that we haven't touched, even after 21, 22 years.
Well, because we talked about how it's an investment and it's about the, you use the word capacity, but it really is about making sure the culture of the institution has a certain kind of perspective that thinks of those kinds of outcomes. And it isn't just one piece of the student pipeline or the student life cycle. It is, how do you include all of that understanding that there are certain outcomes for which the student came to your door in the first place?
Absolutely. We work with colleges to build the capacities to, build a culture that's going to help accelerate student achievement, student completion, and post-completion gains. Community colleges are, I think, the most undervalued, underappreciated, and under-resourced sector of higher education. And so when we work with colleges, we really try to help bolster their capacity through peer learning. I think of us as having a multiplier effect, so that colleges invest in ATD, but they get like a whole lot more from that, primarily because of the opportunity to work and learn with peers.
It's a great opportunity. And I know we've been talking about how do we remain student ready. And that's a concept that I know you very much are aligned with, because it's part of Achieving the Dream's, DNA as well. And we talk about it from multiple aspects, not only from the service aspect, but also the academic offerings. And I saw online, I think it was just last night, that ATD for your data and analytics conference is offering a micro-credential. I think that's absolutely fascinating.
Data capacity is like the number one thing we work with our colleges on. So to become student ready, you have to understand your students. Yeah, and that's through data, qualitative and quantitative. And so we have this annual data and analytics summit, which is now 11 years old. And we partnered with University of Maryland Global Campus last year to beta test this idea that we have a lot of the practitioners that come to the Data Summit. Many of them are institutional research and information technology professionals. The summit's filled with sessions that, when you curate the sessions, it's actually a curriculum that helps develop new capacities and competencies for were these professionals. And so UMGC said, in order to build the next generation of leaders, which we're trying to do, we have to as a sector, how could we translate the Data and Analytics Summit into credit that and micro-credential, a micro-credential and college credit if a student wants to use it to get into the UMGC doctoral program in community college leadership. So you can either get the credit toward the doctorate if you're in that pathway, or you can get the micro-certification from UMGC that, you know, says you've completed these pieces of understanding the student demographics at a community college. I mean, I'm simplifying it, but it is kind of groundbreaking. Last year in the beta, we had about 20 people get the micro-credential. As I think about the next part of ATD and our mission as we develop it, you know, certainly leadership development, especially for mid-level leaders, is really at the core, I think, of something ATD can accelerate and make a difference in the field with.
Absolutely. I thought it was pretty awesome because we talk a lot about education being portable, how it shouldn't look the same for everyone. I mean, you look at other industries, they've been offering CEUs in certain industries for ages. Why not, you know, have something like this for higher ed practitioners?
You know, sometimes we do it with faculty. Sometimes we will embed that in a professional learning pathway for our faculty, but we're less likely to have professional learning pathways for some of our key administrative leaders. They tend to curate their own pathways. You need to do that, but also there are some basic things like data literacy, data understanding, data sense making. Take data and understand what that might mean for action. We find that is a big gap on most of the campuses that we work with. Mm-hmm. Even the most mature Achieving the Dream colleges that have been working with us for 10 or 15 years, the data literacy and data sense-making gap is significant.
Well, and I think to your point, a lot of times people have data and they don't always take the time to analyze what does it really mean and how is it we then translate all this data we have and actually make it usable information that somehow impacts our actions and our decision-making as an institution. And that's the harder part because a lot of the data is collected, you know, on an annual perfunctory type of basis. Some of it, not so much, but there's a lot of tools out there and a lot of surveys and things of that nature to where that other piece is, there's a different level of intentionality around that.
A lot of colleges spend a lot of time, and they need to, but they spend a lot of time on creating dashboards. The dashboards get developed, and then they say, now we have a data culture. Dashboard does not equal data culture. You'd have to, you know, you have to put them into action. And that's where I think we all struggle.
So community colleges, as one of the newer sectors in higher education, we continue to evolve. And I think that that's a great thing. We should continue to evolve forever because if we're truly meeting the needs of our region, then those needs will change. Thus, we need to change with it. But as you're looking at your career in community colleges, there's always been some evolution. And so, you know, if we could talk a little bit about how they've evolved and kind of where you see us going as a sector in the future, but also that economic development, workforce development piece of it. And it really, I mean, it always has been part of it, but at the Dream Conference last year, one of the aspects that really struck me was the research that Federal Reserve Bank, their community outreach sector, had done. And we've been talking about that. We've been talking about our own feasibility study that we did with Trellis Strategies for Toledo and one that is close to completion in Findlay. And so all of that that's coming together, a lot of it really just speaks to economic development and people in general. And so can you talk about the evolution of community colleges and specifically around that workforce and economic development piece?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, for a long time, we looked at ourselves as access institutions. And then the next wave was, okay, now we're going to focus on completion because the Spellings Commission report back in the early 2000s started to really say, okay, there's not a lot of completion at these institutions. There's a lot of access, high access, but low completion, and especially for some for some students more than other students. And we've spent 15 years like doubled down on completion, everybody. And we've made really great gains, but it's not been enough. So we still have to focus on completion, but we need to broaden our definition of completion and connect a lot of those. While I think every degree is also a workforce degree, you know, in some way, but the definition of completion has to extend beyond degrees, academic degrees. It has to include those post-secondary short-term certifications, non-degree credentials, industry certifications, and that has to be built into the definition. So then you start to get more of a workforce orientation built into the completion movement. Colleges are blending the student experience so that students see, okay, well, here are my options in this manufacturing pathway. I can stack different non-degree credentials, or within a degree, I can get a bunch of certifications within the degree, right? So that's a lot of the workforce orientation. But now at the same time, and this is, I think, what the Federal Reserve Board really started to point to, and some more research out there, is that not all degrees and programs are of equal value. So completion to what end? And that's where, you know, tying program portfolios, credit and non-credit, to be aligned with regional workforce needs. That's mm-hmm. like the essence of workforce development now. That the talent gap, filling the talent gap, understanding or building a workforce for a new industry that's potentially coming into your area. You know, and in Ohio, I know there's lots of work around that. And so the next stage is really, I think, around that program thinking and how program links to student economic and social mobility, and how that then links to prosperity. And that recipe, so to speak, I think, brings it more employers to the table, because they see that we're trying to respond. I mean, they've always known, we're known for being flexible and responding, and we have been doing that. But I think we've been doing it with half of our enterprise in the past. And yeah. Now we're talking about our entire organization being focused. Mm-hmm. And I know there's backlash at times when you talk about it that way. To me, it doesn't mean that we're abandoning the humanities. It means we are reinventing the humanities. If there's any sector of higher education that can save the humanities, it's community colleges. Because every one of those credentials requires something in the humanities. That's what you hear about.
And that's what they tell you. I mean, all the time. A lot of times, particularly when there was such a high need at the tail end of the pandemic and immediately post-pandemic, they said, we want people who have, our words, not theirs, universal skills. We need people who can communicate well, who have critical thinking skills, who can show up to work on time, work ethic, empathy for their colleagues. I mean, all of the things that are hardwired into the humanities are part of what it is they're looking for all the time. You just don't see it in their job ads.
Yes. And I even think that AI will ignite a renaissance of the humanities.
That was another thing at the Dream Conference that was striking, was the learning on AI. And that's something our team really has brought back and is trying to lean into, how to best implement its usage and policies, all of that. And so tell me about how AI and the humanities are going to work together.
Well, let me say a little bit about the recently completed AI for All Task Force report that Achieving the Dream just finished, that lays out like 8 areas of potential action for community colleges to really begin to adopt an AI strategy. You know, one of the things that I think, and we learned this from our network survey that we were just analyzing, most of the community colleges in the country are experimenting with AI, but they're looking at the concerns around AI and not the opportunities around AI generally. We have to flip our mindset on that. And I think that means that, you know, our community colleges, and this is part of the task force report, really need to develop an AI strategy. And that might begin with thinking about the way you're creating opportunities for your own workforce to play with AI, creating a sandbox for faculty to play with AI. The connection with the humanities, the guardrails that we have to put in place for AI, I think are based in ethics, critical thinking, helping students understand how to ask questions and how to keep asking questions. You know, there's something about inquiry that the humanities kind of gives us, that grounds us in. And so for us to be able to optimize the use of AI in learning, we have to somehow figure out how to inject the best parts of the humanities into our thinking about AI. I don't quite have the full answer there, but I do know I'm on the National Council for the Humanities, and we have spent a lot of time on that council talking about how does AI influence the humanities and what type of grant making can we do to encourage humanities faculty experimentation with AI. And then, you know, what would a co-joined AI and humanities across the curriculum effort look like? You know, there's a lot of opportunity here to be creative. So I think that if community colleges don't adopt a strategy about AI, we will leave our students behind at a rapid rate. There's already a significant gap for many of our students. You know, think about the digital gap. We don't want to exacerbate that. In addition to that, our students won't be prepared for the workforce. So you go back to the workforce development question. We just can't fail here. The problem is there's not an answer. It's kind of gray territory, but we have to get started. And there's no good place to get started, and there's no wrong place to get started, just getting started. So at ATD, we've done a lot of workshops with faculty, and we've just said, come on to the webinar and let's experiment. Get ChatGPT or whatever it is on your phone or on your iPad or your computer, and let's start to play. You know, I've started to do that. I'm learning a lot. You know, when you get material back from AI, if you don't know the questions to ask, if you don't have that framing for thinking, critical analysis, it's tempting just to dump what you get into a response. And you can't do that. It's not doing insight making.
There was a presentation by one of our local AI companies at a meeting I went to. And the presenter, who's the head of this company, said almost the exact same thing. And he talked about teaching people with no computer experience AI, but that the human experience is what gets you a quality result. And he talked about whatever the problem was. I don't remember the, you know, basic problem that they were going to solve, but he talked about how it would almost send them down a rabbit hole. And because he had experience in whatever this was, he could say, no, you don't have to do that. Just do this. And I always remember, however many years ago now it was, when the internet became available to all. And I remember librarians as a profession having an outcry of, oh my goodness, people still need to know how to read and have critical thinking skills. And this so much reminds me of that, of how, you know, there has to be what's appropriate usage. What are the right guardrails? What are the, you know, way in which you can use this tool that can enhance things?
The other thing to be thinking about is how the college can use AI to improve supports for students, or at least the wayfinding experience for students in connecting them to the human that they need to see. You know, you see a lot of use of the chatbots and other AI tools. AI can be a support for accelerating productivity in areas like institutional research, finance. You know, there's all kinds of creative ways for us to use AI to be more productive. At ATD, we have an internal AI team, and they're all going through an exercise now where they're trying to create their own AI agent. And I've been doing a lot of reading about that and trying to figure out, well, what would my AI agent do? What would their job description be? I think about the things that I'm spending time on that I probably don't need to spend time on. I do think that there will be some erosion or change in jobs, and maybe some of the very entry-level jobs either will go away or morph so that those in entry-level jobs are actually doing higher order work. So the implications, I'm not quite sure yet what that means. But we, you know, if we're going to have programs that are going to be relevant, we're going to need to understand the influence of AI in the workplace in our local regions.
Absolutely. No, it makes perfect sense. And I remember a long time ago being at an institution and starting up online registration. And again, it's not quite AI as we understand it now, But there was kind of, you know, a feeling of loss for some of the professionals whose job was to register students. And the institutional philosophy was, let's get technology to do the things to help us be efficient and save the humans for the things that technology can't yet do. And that's a hard message to hear when you feel threatened, or if you feel as though your livelihood is threatened. But it's that same cycle that's kind of repeating itself of using it as a tool, not being, you know, a victim and succumbing to the tool.
And that goes back again to the humanities. Empathy, I think, comes from some grounding in the humanities. And you're absolutely right. I think AI will force us to be more humanistic in our work and in our approaches.
Absolutely. What else, you know, as a sector, should community colleges be prepared for, you know, that might not be yet on the radar?
I think we still have work to do. I'm going to go back to that, what ATD calls our community vibrancy model. We talk a lot about return on investment, which is kind of an internal term. We need to get better at translating that into return on education so that a student and their family understands the value and get tools to do that. And now there's so much publicly available data that the data is available. It's just that we have to organize the data and change our mindset. And then we have to get stronger at translating that into what that means for community benefit. When an organization is looking for transformation, you know, maybe the old model might have been, well, we're going to increase completion by 50%. We'll just make that up. Now, I think the new goals are going to be around identifying some metric in the community that you want to change in collaboration with community, and then map back what that means for the design of your programs and services, rather than starting with completion and mapping back. And I think that requires a different kind of leadership mindset and a lot more work in the community. I mean, I think we are bound. I don't like to call us anchor institutions because that to me is static. I like to call us boundary spanning institutions. And when you think about it that way, it's fluid. We're creating relationships constantly, and we're trying to figure out how to co-design a shared goal. You know, I think the old way was transactional. I think the new way is creating shared goals with community and then mapping back. And that's hard to do, but I think if we can get there, when I was college president, I used to say community colleges should take the form of their communities. And then later I said, and while taking the form, also shape the form of the community. That's where I think we need to go and go there boldly. There's no one else that can do that.
So one of the things that you've shared with the world is that you plan to retire from your role at Achieving the Dream at the end of June of 2026. What are the things that are the highlights of your Achieving the Dream career?
Yeah, that word retire is hard because I really plan to continue to evolve. And one of the interesting things, and this is a whole different conversation for leaders to think about, is that ATD has great momentum and is on a wonderful trajectory. It's in great shape. And it's at that stage of transformation where we're mature and we need to be redreaming. Like, what are we going to be next? That cycle. And as an individual leader, I'm at that same stage. And sometimes I think it's healthy for that. It doesn't necessarily have to be done in tandem again. But like, I've been through 3 or 4 cycles of that with Achieving the Dream. So I'm looking for something new that's going to spark my curiosity and that I can still have a voice in the movement, because I love community colleges and you know that. When I look back, say 5 years from now, you know, I think Achieving the Dream, I'm hoping that we were a leader in accelerating the completion rates for all students at all community colleges. And I think we are close to being able to say that that was work even before I came to Achieving the Dream. But with the future and the stage that we're setting right now with the expectations around student success, I would like to be able to say, because of that work at Achieving the Dream, more community colleges are high access and high mobility colleges. They're not just high access and high completion colleges but they're high access and high mobility colleges. I hope that there'd be some sense of that presidents would be able to talk about value, not with new language, about how that translates to community prosperity. And I know, too, that when colleges come into our network and they form their teams and they have, you know, their leadership teams and they have faculty, they have all these engaged teams, that the work of ATD in some way touches every individual on those teams and inspires them to stay in community colleges, possibly get on a path toward higher service at a community college. So I'm hoping that because of the work that I've done in Achieving the Dream, we've built a good pool or cadre for the next generation of community college leaders with an abundance mindset about the abundancy of our colleges rather than, and the possibilities rather than the problems and the restrictions. Because we could spend a whole podcast on the challenges right now and the restrictions, but I hope that what I've brought is hope for leaders that's inspired in some way by centering students in everything that we do. And I do think already, I think ATD and my own particular appreciation for data, that there is a legacy there around that that can be built upon.
I agree. I mean, to think about your role and ATD's role in helping community colleges focus and recenter on what our mission is and how to translate that in today's context is huge. And I think being able to help institutions see that not only from a larger strategic perspective, but also to be able to think about what does that look like in implementation and what are the things that we need to do to make sure that everyone in our community can take advantage of an education and reap the benefits of that education. And I'm grateful for the work that Achieving the Dream has done, because not only is it for member institutions, but I think of the work that ATD has inspired in other organizations as well that carry that water, that look at some of the same values and implementation and how it translates into performance overall for community colleges individually, but also as a sector. So I'm incredibly grateful for the work that you've done and that ATD has done.
Thank you for reminding me of the influence beyond just the network, because there's a lot of colleges that look at ATD and the fundamentals of ATD and bring them into their institutions. Owens has done that, I think. I call them ATD curious colleges. That's the ripple effect piece that sometimes you underestimate. I really hope that we can continue to inspire people to look at community colleges as a career opportunity and to stay in community colleges and to help them understand the red thread that community college, like the excitement that being in a community college can bring to you and the sense of fulfillment. Those that have experienced community colleges the way we have and the way our faculty and staff have understand the secret sauce of community colleges. I hope we keep people. I hope we can attract more people. I appreciate your leadership. That would be the one of like my last thing. It's been just a pleasure to watch the progression at Owens and to work with you and to be a guest and have this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Stout, thank you so much for being with us today. We're so grateful to you for your hard work and leadership on behalf of community colleges across the country. Thank you for your support and your time today. And thank you to all of our listeners. Please remember to subscribe and join us for future conversations. Until next time, take care.